When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
You know Cheryl Burke from her 26 seasons on Dancing with the Stars. But behind the rhinestones and glam, Cheryl's life was filled with trauma, addiction, and abandonment. All of this has profoundly affected her life. Cheryl says she's never had a healthy, romantic relationship. On this powerful episode of Navigating Narcissism, Cheryl and I explore the roots of the painful, traumatic, and difficult life she's endured, what she's learned about herself, and how a conversation with me years ago led to a significant revelation about her own father. From Red Table Talk Podcast and iHeartMedia, I'm Dr. Romani, and this is Navigating Narcissism. This podcast should not be used as a substitute for medical or mental health advice. Individuals are advised to seek independent medical advice, counseling, and/or therapy from a healthcare professional with respect to any medical condition, mental health issue, or health inquiry, including matters discussed on this podcast. This episode discusses abuse, which may be triggering to some people. The views and opinions expressed are solely those of the podcast author or individuals participating in the podcast and do not represent the opinions of Red Table Talk Productions, iHeartMedia, or their employees. Cheryl?
Yes.
You and I actually met a few years ago when I was on your podcast and you talked to me about narcissism.
Right.
And even a foreshadow, you said, oh, you should have your podcast at the
yes.
time I didn't. And here we are, and even better, you're a guest.
Who knew I was psychic?
So okay. Thank you.
Of course. I want you to know how much you have affected my life in a way that you probably don't know. But when you were on the podcast, we did talk about my real father who has passed, and you mentioned how the qualities of a narcissist, right? Mm-hmm. And it really put everything into perspective for me. Mm-hmm. And in a weird way, I was able to not necessarily validate, you know, his actions or anything, but to at least be able to label it in a way and have some sort of peace as to, okay, so my father was a narcissist. And that was a huge revelation. So thank you.
Well, I appreciate that so much. I think having a frame for something sometimes it's even just about lifting some of that self-blame and recognizing that it's a structural thing that was simply going to happen to anyone who happens to be in the position you were in as his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And it lifts us out of the story. You were still hurt by it. You were still affected by
Absolutely.
It. None of that
still
is taken away.
Yeah.
But it's a whole nother level when you feel at all that you're partly responsible for it.
Right.
And that's
totally.
The piece that the framework helps with. What is amazing about you is how much candor you bring when you share your stories and your experiences. And it is so important because people do see you as a performer. People almost project a lot of stuff onto you. And when you stop being the person on the screen, the dancer, and you show your humanity, but also what you've been through with such vulnerability, you give permission to millions of other people to lift some of the shame off of themselves. So I always think it's powerful when somebody who has a public platform does that kind of open sharing. I don't think people quite understand what an impact that has. So I would say that on the behalf of many survivors, thank you so much. And you've shared some really profound and painful experiences, from experiencing sexual abuse as a child to even a journey of sobriety. So all of this is the kinds of things people grapple with but don't talk about.
Thanks for creating an amazing outlet and resource for people, because
this is
very important. I heard you say recently that though it may seem like we're going through this as a collective of being able to talk about our traumas, at the same time, we're not, you know, and on top of it all, because of, you know, social media, there's amazing things about it, but there's also the negative things about it, which is people feeling like they have the right to judge you for being vulnerable. And to say that I don't get affected by it to this day would be a lie. I'm already being vulnerable. And then on top of it, I'm being questioned as to why I'm being vulnerable.
Correct.
Or I'm oversharing. So thank you for educating and continuing to have these uncomfortable conversations.
Well, yeah, I do appreciate that. And I agree with you. I think that we often are, we're open to these stories almost only to the point where sort of we learn the information, but we don't want to hear the emotion and what it does to the person. You know, it's always like what I call sort of trauma storytelling, that we're just, we want to hear the terrible thing that happened. But that's a tiny top of an iceberg.
Yeah.
The rest of it is how it shaped a person and how it affects how they go through the world and how they've had to carry that burden and how they ultimately put some of that down and grow and heal and sometimes have setbacks. That really is where the focus needs to be. But I think we get so caught up in the, tell me what happened. Okay, now I'm done.
Yeah.
And that
or
actually,
not believing them.
Or not believing
them. That's the worst.
Or when you bring the emotion in, people are like, oh, that's enough. We've
heard it.
And we don't want to hear your raw emotion.
Yeah.
And so that's definitely what this is, really a space about survivors. And I think all of these stories that come up, they're much more perpetrator focused. We're so curious about people who do bad things, right? But what we don't really ever unpack is what happens to the person who experienced the bad things. And it is remarkable to me how uninterested we've historically been.
Or who gets then almost made out to be the perpetrator.
And that's actually something, interestingly, Cheryl, we talked about with an expert of ours, Dr. Fried, who developed a model of that called DARVO. DARVO is an acronym developed by Dr. Jennifer Fried and stands for Deny, Attack, and Reverse Victim and Offender. It is the way manipulative and abusive people respond to accusations. I like to think of it as supercharged gaslighting. When you face up to an abuser about their behavior, they will deny it, attack you for calling them out, and then flip to behaving like the victim and shaping the narrative as though you are harming them. It can leave many people in abusive relationships feeling as though they are the ones who have done something wrong.
I'll never forget, I got sexually molested when I was a little girl, and I testified against him in court when I was like 9 years old. And I remember even that time, as if it was yesterday, I just felt, I was here sitting in front of the perpetrator, right? And it wasn't just me, it was quite a few people. They wouldn't let my mom with me inside the court. And I will never forget feeling like I was doing something wrong, like I was lying. That's, I would say, the start of not necessarily trusting myself, because in a way, it was a way of grooming. This man did a great job of doing that. Like, it wasn't physical pain. And it was to the point where I started questioning myself, like, as to, like, did he do anything bad? Because he never hurt me. And then it didn't help being, like, testifying against this man and not necessarily, I didn't feel like I was being believed at all. And it was just a horrible feeling. I'll never forget it.
It's a horrible feeling when you also stack that up. You're 9 years old. If any of us close our eyes and think back to how young nine is.
Yeah, that's young.
Right? Mm-hmm. Adult survivors of any form of sexual assault or trauma rarely testify in their cases. So what you did would have been beyond the pale for even an adult. And it's understandable why nobody wants to testify in these cases.
Right.
These systems are all designed to give perpetrators their rights. That's how our justice system is set up. And to be doubting of the accuser, that is the foundation of how this justice system is set up. It's innocent until proven guilty. Mm-hmm. Well, if that's the case, that means an accuser is then being viewed through a suspicious lens. right? And that's particularly pronounced and profound when a person is bringing sexual trauma, especially
as a
child,
yeah.
as a minor, whose brain hasn't really developed in a way to fully integrate what this is. Children look to adults for safety.
100%.
That's what they do. So when an adult violates a child's safety, mm-hmm. the child doesn't actually have a good template
right.
to turn to for that. And so the child's go-to mm-hmm. is to figure out how they're complicit in this, because that story allows them to be safer in the world at large.
Right.
Otherwise, the world becomes real dangerous, real fast, mm-hmm. all adults become potentially risky. You
yeah.
know, we talk about people being invalidating and traumatizing mm-hmm. and frankly narcissistic. Systems are too. I think the judicial system is a great example
yeah.
of a system that is invalidating and traumatizing, especially for survivors of any form of sexual violence.
Yeah, thanks for saying all of that. It just reminds me of people in general who suffer in silence because of the fact of either feeling like they weren't believed when telling their story
yeah.
or there's so much shame mm-hmm. because of not being able to or feeling like they can't communicate mm-hmm. it. You know, I was blessed, I guess, enough for my mom to put me into therapy since I was a little girl, and mm-hmm. I haven't stopped. And it's mm-hmm. something that it's non-negotiable in my life. But it has been really hard to put everything into words. My body, because I'm a dancer,
yes.
I have a somatic therapist, I have
Good.
A talk therapist, but the somatic is a lot easier. But I'm still learning how to be able to communicate this through talking.
It's so interesting you say that, Cheryl, because trauma is very much encoded and stored mm-hmm. somatically. That's where we keep it. And,
mm-hmm.
and what we've learned in the last 30 years of trauma treatment is that that somatic focus is a game changer,
oh my
right?
gosh.
And reorienting to our bodies. What's remarkable to me is you, as a trauma survivor,
mm-hmm.
your body became your form of art.
Oh, my God.
So what an ultimate way to heal, but
yeah.
also it's
also
really
weird,
amazing.
Too. You're like,
yeah.
but you're going to stuff yourself in a dance costume when you've been mm-hmm. violated,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And be comfortable dancing in front of millions of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For people who are listening, you know, when we're talking about how we hold things somatically, we hold them in our
mm-hmm.
body. So trauma gets held in the body. And I've
for
been
years,
working for years.
If you
I mean,
want,
if
yeah,
not if, lifetimes.
Yeah.
And I have to say, over the years, it would be many times people wouldn't connect. It would be even
mm-hmm.
things like when people felt they couldn't speak. The strangulation
hmm.
in the throat.
Yeah.
Anxiety. It's
yeah.
felt in
yes.
the gut. It's felt in the head. It's
yes.
felt in the shoulders.
Oh,
it's
my God. Yes.
And that's often where people would process it first,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's then teaching people, do you understand? I always say that the brain, the mind often gaslights the body.
Yes.
The body's holding all the truth and the brain's
yes.
like, come on, like
yes,
you're being drama
it's the
body,
ego. Yeah,
right?
It's that
and
ego.
So, but
yeah.
I think that it's because
you're
the
right.
brain and the body are serving different functions.
Yeah. Yeah.
The brain is trying to keep you safe,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's like, body,
fight,
don't tell me this,
yeah.
like everything's
yeah.
dangerous. No, 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 we can't work with that, right?
Yeah.
And so the brain's like, just chill, body, because I can't manage this much
yes.
threat. And the body feels the threat. One of the things we often see with trauma survivors is you can teach them to trust their body sometimes a little quicker than we can teach them to trust their minds, right? Because this is where it's all held.
Because you can't hide the feeling.
You can't hide the feeling. You can't hide
you
the
really
sensation.
Can't.
But a lot of people don't connect the dots.
Interesting.
They have the sensation. They've had this experience. But what they don't realize is that this stuff that's held in their body, the somatic stuff,
yeah.
and that their body is signaling something to them. And so that's why, in some ways, your body is an interesting early detection device,
mm-hmm.
because I will tell particularly people who have survived any kind of trauma, whether it be physical, sexual, or even emotional, listen to your body, because your poor brain has been trying to run circles and make sense of it.
And it does tell you, it does.
And listen that.
Yeah.
And when you're feeling that, that might be a sign to say, you know what, I think I'm going to step out
yes.
of this situation, because there's a lot of data there. But
it's
we,
like that
right?
feeling when you're like, do I walk through this alleyway or not? Like you
yeah.
just know,
you, know.
It, you just need to give mm-hmm. it a second and trust it.
Mm-hmm.
It's body awareness, just knowing when your stomach hurts or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Ouch, you ran to the door. Done that a few times,
mm-hmm.
you know, it hurts, like,
mm-hmm.
and just acknowledging it. But yes, I'm blessed that dance was my form of, I'm blessed, first of all, that my mom was able to afford my dancing career, but also my mom thought I was deaf growing up because I didn't talk at all.
Mm-hmm.
She took me to a hearing specialist who said, no, miss, but your daughter's going through PTSD, which is why she's not talking. Like,
how?
So this was even before the sexual abuse.
My mom and dad
divorced when I was two. So that was very traumatic. And though it was like yesterday, another traumatic event happened was witnessing my father being intimate with another woman at such a young age. Though they were separated, I didn't put two and two together. So that was like my very first memory as a kid.
Okay, so let's go backwards, all right? Let's go backwards. So you were not talking. You didn't really start talking
late.
Until you were two.
No, two, way three, after that.
Three, four.
Maybe five.
Five, yeah, okay. All right, five, so that would have been something that would have jumped out. Okay.
Yeah.
But at two, you said your parents divorced.
Right.
Can you talk to me about that period of time? Because it sounds like that was
separated.
Yeah. But that's a significant event for such a young child
time.
Who has no language to even understand what was happening.
Yeah.
So what was all that like?
Well, it was interesting because my mother's Filipina. She was raised, long story short, in poverty and moved here to the States and created a nursing agency called Nurse Provider. So she opened up the very first nursing agency, like how we as talent have agents. So she was very, very busy. And I was born in 84, and that's when her company had just started. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't a lot of, I guess I was raised with my Filipina nanny more than anybody as far as my parents go. So there's that. We're living in the Bay Area where I'm from. And I just remember going bouncing from house to house. So my father's home for a couple of days and then my mom, you know, but then my Filipina nanny was with me at all times.
Oh, so she'd go from house to back
Correct.
And forth.
Yes. But still, like, she wasn't able to drive. She didn't speak English. So that was another reason why I didn't talk, because we had two different languages spoken in home.
You had a lot going on, and that kind of the chaos, the multiple languages, all of that. I mean, now we would probably have assessed a child like you very differently. But what I'm hearing is busy parents, distracted parents.
Yes.
You're going back and forth. The only consistent through line in your life is
a paid nanny
who didn't speak English.
Yep.
What I'm hearing is being affected, though, is attachment.
I am totally anxious attachment.
Okay. All right. And so let's talk a little bit about what an anxious attachment is, because people can say, well, what does that mean if someone's anxiously attached?
No. Yes.
What does it mean to you before I launch into sort of a professorial what anxious attachment is?
I love this already. I could talk to you for weeks. I have anxiety when it comes to, first of all, relationships, but abandonment issues. It's interesting because me and my therapist were talking about this in length, actually, about avoidant versus anxious. And I'm a little bit of both, but I'm mainly anxious. Though the avoidant had just started to happen because of the fear of feeling needy and maybe feeling rejected because of my anxious attachment issue, that I then quickly switch over to becoming avoidant. So it all, like, it's not either or.
What
right?
does that look like when you become, so if you go?
So like if I feel rejected by, let's say, if I'm like, oh, let's cuddle, or like I'm extra vulnerable, right? Through my body. And I don't feel like that other person is open to it, then I will right away, my wall goes up fast.
Right. And so, you know, where
as
this
protective.
You're protecting. Right.
Yes, I'm protecting myself.
And this kind of, you know, the kind of early inconsistency and mild chaos you were living in will impact attachment. So, you know, the gold standard that what we hope for everybody is a secure attachment.
Of course.
And with a secure attachment, the child feels safe. They feel that they have readily available caregivers that they can beckon and make needs known to, and they feel safe expressing those needs, and that those needs would not be rejected or the child would be abandoned. It's so interesting to me to see you. You literally gave this big exhale
as I said it.
Yeah. You know, that is as though something
good.
That you want and wish for, right?
Yeah.
Children can be,
but then realize that only I can do that for myself as an adult.
But some children can be securely attached to one caregiver and not to another.
Of course.
But when we get into the area,
Then we had my second caregiver who molested me.
There you go. See, so that's what we're going to get to.
Yeah.
Is that now when a caregiver engages in harm, you were older than then.
I was, a couple years.
Uh-huh. So not much older, but those early, early caregiver attachments, those become really profoundly important. As other people come into the sphere of the child, it's still going to affect attachment. And the way they researched this was they would actually look at what's called separation behavior and reunion behavior. So children being separated from their caregiver, usually in this research, it was a mother, how they would do it goodbye and how they would do it hello.
Oh, I was not good with goodbye.
Right.
I was like,
and that's
I will never forget
attachment.
It. I was, my mom was dressed up in a ball gown. And like, mind you, she was working like long hours. I remember grabbing onto her ankle. I'll never forget it. And she was with her friends. And it was with any goodbyes.
Any goodbyes. I suck at it. And it generalizes this to all goodbyes, right?
Yes.
So the goodbye is chaotic and there's a lot of distress and it takes a minute to soothe the child. Yeah. Then the child does their thing. Then when the child comes back with the caregiver, there's this almost like a, don't, like, you're back, don't leave me again. And almost like a frenzied reunion, right?
Yeah.
That's the only way I could describe it.
Yes, yes, yes.
In the avoidantly attached child, when the point of separation comes, they kind of walk off. And when the parent comes back, there could be some tears, some agitation, but by and large, they remain disinterested.
What are the parents like when you're avoidant attachment?
They're neglectful. It's very much a more neglectful
setting. But what's the difference? Like neglectful versus just
intrusive.
Being busy.
That's a neglect, but there's also, there was intrusiveness too, right?
Uh-huh,
there was also
uh-huh.
like, it's not as though you didn't think there was anyone there.
Right, right, right.
You know, it's that they were there and they were kind of
see.
Like up, down, in, uh-huh. out, probably over-involved, under-involved, uh-huh. that kind of thing. That it's not like nobody there.
Got it. Can you get to the secure attachment? It takes a lot of work.
It does, you know, but here's the thing. You said you're in therapy. Therapy becomes actually one of those places where the secure attachment gets created again.
Right.
You know, that the therapist is there on time and they're there and available.
Yes. No,
and they don't reject you because you say something.
No, yeah.
And that if in long-term psychotherapy, that can be one place for it. Really healthy friendships that persist for a long time. We can have these safe, secure bases we slowly start to create. Some people will say some of that starts for them when they have children, that they become a secure base for the child. Now, some anxiously attached parents can also be hovery. Mm-hmm. So they really need to get their stuff in order before they have a child is a good way to do it. Have a dog first. I think it absolutely can be.
Interesting.
It can be reworked in adult relationships, but it has to be intentional. It can't just be that you get lucky and you find
a
good friend.
Of course, it takes work.
So, but then you said at the age of three, I just want to understand what happened, that you walked in on your father.
Yes.
And he was having sex with someone, obviously not your mother.
Yeah, no.
How did
look
that
look like my mother?
Okay.
He had a type.
How did that, you obviously have a
that
memory.
That was traumatic.
That's traumatic.
Yeah, and I'll never forget as well, like, I remember, you know, because I was staying there, so I had to shower, you know, and I needed help. So he'd make me shower with this, like, woman who was his secretary. Yeah, it was pretty traumatic seeing that. And I just remember seeing, opening the door and seeing just, like, the back of her. She had long black hair. It's interesting. Like, and she was naked, obviously. This is how much detail I know. I was sitting in my dad's brown leather chair watching Sesame Street on PBS, and I wanted him to change the channel. And I go in and there was like a crack in the door and then I saw him, you know, being with this other woman. And obviously I didn't know it was his secretary back then. Obviously I didn't know. I couldn't put anything into words at the moment. But of course it was traumatic. And I think that was the start of, you know, what I thought love was.
And what would that be? What
it would be all unhealthy, I guess, toxic traits of a man, which is a narcissistic personalities, abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't just say that because of my father. I say this because of the perpetrator as well, the person who sexually abused me. And then on top of it all, like the pattern, that was my definition of love, was the man who wasn't available.
Well,
to me.
That's what it is. It's the chaos, right? Love becomes associated with chaos.
I would still say I'm a recovering addict, but still, like, there is that feels like home still sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
my lazy brain, as I say, which is just me not being present or conscious as much, it goes back to that, like, easily.
So that early instance, okay, you walk in on your father. So your father, who is, in theory, these are his few days with you, he's not being an attentive caregiver.
No.
Instead, what he's doing is, you know, having this fling with his secretary.
Right.
You see this, okay?
Yes, yeah. And he knows. I would assume he knew.
Right. This one instance was, I mean, Cheryl, people have walked in on their on parents, maybe even parents and someone else having sex, right? It's an image that often stays with people.
Mm-hmm.
That event was one. How did that connect to your larger relationship with your father? Because it doesn't sound like that
my dad
one
left.
Event was it.
So he left the country for his own selfish reasons. So my dad was a very successful lawyer in the Bay Area and then followed his passion. And I won't say it here. It starts with the P, ends with the Y. But opened up a bunch of strip clubs.
That's his passion.
Right. Correct. Okay. It was. Rest in peace. I'm sure it's no longer his passion, I would hope. You never know
what happens on the other side.
That's for sure. I can't tell you any different. I mean, I'm just assuming or maybe dreaming that he's now like this. Who knows? Anyway, rest in peace, Dad. But yeah, so he had a bunch of strip clubs in Pattaya in Thailand. And clearly he loved his Asian women and opened up a bunch of strip clubs. I was exposed to that world because my mom wanted me to continue having a relationship with my father. Didn't want to obviously, I guess, promote me not talking to him or seeing him. So it was like a once a year, it was a family getaway to Pattaya. Not at his strip clubs, but he did live on top of his strip clubs. Called Bubbles.
So when you would go to Thailand for these vacations on atop of Bubbles.
And with my stepdad, with my stepsister, my mom.
Oh, so your mom.
It was a family affair.
So mom, stepfather, sister.
So you, my mom remarried. Yeah. So.
Would you stay on top of Bubbles or would you?
No, we would stay at the Holiday Inn.
Okay.
And so it's way nicer there, just FYI, than it is here.
Okay. You'd stay at the Holiday Inn. But it was, you were very aware of the whole, what was, you mean
it was clubs.
It was clubs.
I was never going in the club. Right. Okay. And my dad was an alcoholic. So he was only able to talk to us in a civil way after 5 p.m. So we wouldn't talk to him before 5 and we would see him between the windows of 5 and 8. And he loved to have long dinners and long talks and conversations. I'd be jet lagged. I'd fall asleep wherever we are. And he would take my stepdad out once a year and it would be at one of his clubs. That's all I remember. And then the rest, we went to go see elephants. Like it was not very eventful.
Okay. So you, what that also communicates is that your father made a choice. He left his one daughter.
Yeah.
Okay. And when she's a very small child to pursue his strip club dream. In Thailand.
Yes.
So he's not doing this in the Bay Area.
No.
He's doing this on the other side of the world and leaves you for his own need.
Right.
With no awareness, no reflection, no empathy.
And no care, really.
No care.
Yeah, honestly. Like I remember dance when I started in the ballroom dancing competitive world. My mom signed me up to do this competition in Hong Kong. And we're like, oh, because it's close by. Mm. You know, your dad can finally see you in person after all these years he hasn't come to see you. And he, I'll never forget it. I got a call the night before our flight and he flaked. And that was very, very traumatic for me. Because he was just not available. And when he was, it was between the hours of 5 and 8 p.m.
How old were you when the ballroom dancing competition thing
I was like 13 or 14.
So all those years, you kept maintaining hope around
him.
Yeah,
of course. And it was interesting because to this day, I feel like my real father will always know more about me than my mom in a way because I felt like I was never judged by him because he couldn't tell me what to do because he was never there. As I got older, we would have long talks and conversations like as if he was a buddy of mine. But still, so much pain, you know, I could and always still wanting to feel like I was being though I wasn't validated. I'm still yearning for that, you know.
Every child wants that, though. I think that what we forget about children, because it's not comparable to describe what happens to a child with a narcissistic parent as what happens to an adult in a narcissistic relationship, right?
Right.
The child can't be taught that the parent is never going to see you, get you, recognize you, acknowledge you. I mean, he wasn't around. He wasn't in your life physically. So it wasn't a real safety need. Like he wasn't sort of like the one locking the door at night.
No.
But it was more of a, that psychologically we feel like we have to have these attachment needs and they shape who we are. Mm-hmm. I am valid because my parents love me, right? And so the hope that a child keeps creating around that. And when parents are chronically disappointing, as many narcissistic parents are. And remember, narcissistic parents, they come in two forms. Either they're over-intrusive and they're constantly
in
your stuff.
That.
You know, it wasn't that, right? And where then you have these detached narcissistic parents.
My mom was.
Your mom was, right.
So love
then
you, Mom.
You're a detached, detached narcissistic parent who they will think nothing of not showing up. They'll think you should just get over it. You're just, you're a secondary thought.
Yeah.
If it had lined up for him and he had some reason to be in Hong Kong, he would have shown up at your thing and expected to be the hero.
Right, it was fear of flying. It was paranoia, like nothing to do with me, right?
Fear of flying, but he managed to get to Thailand.
Right. Nothing to do with me yet. I thought back then everything to do with me.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
so
of course.
So you feel like it's your fault. Everything is your fault. And then those are the men I dated.
That's right. And that idea of everything your fault, that's at the center of classical mm-hmm. formulations of trauma, like Judith Herman's work, who studied children who've gone through trauma.
Her work is sort of seminal
work on this idea of mm-hmm. the child takes responsibility.
What's her name again?
Judith Herman.
Okay.
And that stays with the person their entire lives. We will be right back with this conversation.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
And yeah. So, okay, so you've gotten interested in dancing and your mom has invested the money for you to take dance classes.
Which is not cheap.
Yeah. And now you're competitively dancing.
All over the world at 13.
Amazing. So you
traveling
were just really
alone.
Good at this, obviously, which we now know for sure. But even at 13.
Well, I was wanting to, like, that's my personality as, I'm an addict. I'm a recovering addict. Mm-hmm. But I'm all or nothing, which is why, my therapist and I have for years now worked consistently on the gray area because it is very black or white for me in my mind.
Have you ever thought of all or nothingness like that almost to be a form of dissociation? It's a way to not feel pain, right?
Girl, you're speaking my language. Yes, I just got chills. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm really good at productivity. Mm-hmm. That's my new drug. Yeah.
Productivity is actually
the worst drug ever.
The 21st century.
Oh my God,
everyone thinks you're a hero for engaging
they
in
are,
this
especially in this country,
yeah.
because I've lived mm-hmm. everywhere almost. Mm-hmm. And I swear this is the only country that celebrates the hustle. And it's actually nothing to celebrate.
Mm-hmm. No,
because
agreed.
With that comes stress. Yep. With that comes, mm-hmm. Oh my God, mm-hmm. I mean, I could talk about that for hours. But mm-hmm. yes, and my mother was that, right? Mm-hmm. So is that she was raised in a Filipina family where vulnerability wasn't celebrated. Mm-hmm. It was ashamed, like you were not supposed to show that side mm-hmm. of you coming from the Asian culture. And then on top of it all, she numbed through productivity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she went from rags to riches and that was her straight up her by herself hustle.
I mean, again, emotion is very good, but I think also having something that absorbs your mind, that's healthy, mm-hmm. something that absorbs your mind, but using that to numb yourself and in essence dissociate.
Even unconsciously.
So that's right, because you're not processing the stuff you need to process.
No.
And then you're doomed to keep repeating these trauma mm-hmm. cycles because you're not actually addressing
feeling.
It. Right. So your numbing was coming through this competitive dancing.
Well, then it was alcohol.
And then it was alcohol. When did you start drinking?
When I moved here. When I started Dancing with the Stars in 2006.
In 2006.
When I was 21.
You're
21. So I started when I was legal.
Okay, so you're legal. Okay, so you're dancing
competitively. Well, I had a Smirnoff Ice on my debutante's ball when I was 18.
Okay, so you dance competitively.
Mm-hmm.
Dad's not in your life. Doesn't even
my stepdad
really show
is my dad at this
your
point.
Okay,
yeah.
Your stepfather.
Amazing.
Your stepfather is great. Wonderful.
Still is. Yeah. So but however, important. He did, I mean, I'm not saying, I'm just saying mm-hmm. the facts here. He, the person who sexually molested me came from, his side, I guess, he brought this man who was taking care of his daughter. I'm not blaming him by any means,
but
I'm just letting you know the facts.
Right. Mm-hmm. But that was also a disruption in
absolutely.
Safety. So in
100%.
Our minds, we pair things, right? Mm-hmm. We learn things through association. So much as you love him and he's been a good person mm-hmm. in your life, he is associated with then bringing in this really harrowing experience into your life. But then what? You get to 18.
Okay, well, 13 to 18. Okay, so I lost my virginity at 13.
Mm.
Ballroom dancing is very intimate.
Mm-hmm.
We're basically dry humping each other just so that everyone knows this is how intimate it is. The ballroom industry reminds me of the entertainment industry mm-hmm. a lot. Lots of narcissists, lots of great things as well. It's all about unfortunately, the way you look. And it's all about, like, it's old school. It is a man's world in a way. The man leads, the woman follows. Mm-hmm. And it's like that in real life behind mm-hmm. the ballroom and all the glitz and glamour of it mm-hmm. as well. And we're all just hustling, competing, fighting for our lives for a stupid trophy at the end of the day. I mean, it's not like you win millions of dollars. Right. Like, if anything, you're spending money.
For the costumes and everything.
Which then is why, like, when it comes to traveling, my mom, obviously, she worked her ass off, and she paid for everything. But not everyone can do that in the ballroom world.
Right.
So, like, these kids are, sometimes dancing on the streets. And I remember doing that in Union Square once because my mom and I got in a fight and she goes, I'm not paying for your airline ticket to England. And I dance on the street. I made like $2,000 with my dance partner, like just for the day. So it's possible, right, to do it. Yeah. But when you're a teenager, the hustle was already starting for me. And I was going to England, just to quickly mention this, Blackpool was like our version of the Olympics. Mm. And that happens every May. Mm-hmm. And so you'd have to take political lessons. You have to like go there and train. And we would spend summers there. And my mom couldn't always come with me. I couldn't always have a chaperone because both parents were working full time. And, you know, my chaperone was my stepsister, which honestly was not a great chaperone. I had to chaperone her at some point. But like, really, it was like you are living this world of playing dress up and working your ass off, blood, sweat and tears. And you're with this one person who is your dance partner. So things are bound to happen.
Mm-hmm. So it was a dance partner.
Yeah. You're,
okay. And so that sounds like that was sort of, we'll say, normative in that world.
Yeah.
You know, not normal.
I also
looked normative.
Like this when I was 13. So.
Okay. Well, So then, you know, you were.
I was very developed. You know.
Okay. And that's young, though. 13
very young.
Is young.
To yes. Start, and didn't feel good.
You know, to start having sex. Mm-hmm. And so you go from 13 to 18. Mm-hmm. Did you do school remotely or did you go back to school?
No, like, I would go to high school.
You go to high school and then do the dancing on the weekends.
But then I was like living two lives. And then I had a boyfriend also after, you know, that first partner. Because I had like a total of 8 to 10 partners throughout my competitive world.
And dance partners.
Dance partners. Yeah, okay. No, not. My sophomore year, I got into two very abusive relationships. That was when that started.
That's young. Again, young for these things. An adult person's brain can't process an abusive relationship. And after already having been through really abandonment by your father, abandonment might be a strong word for your mother, but she certainly was not in your life. You know what I'm saying? As much
physically,
as she could.
Physically, not as
much as she could have
course.
Been. But she was there and she was supporting
there.
You financially.
Absolutely. She did the best she could.
You were sexually abused and now you're 13, having sex, you're young. And then you're in emotionally abusive relationships and you're far away from home.
And I'm looking out for outside validation, clearly, by joining this ballroom competitive world full of lashes, rhinestones, and spray tans.
So those are your teens. And then you turn 18, right? I mean, that's sort of the magic adult moment. Did things shift in terms of you graduated high school?
I had a debutante ball.
Oh.
That's my mom's fault.
Okay.
She made me.
Okay.
I was very shy growing up in my teens. Mm-hmm. But again, dance was my way of communicating. Mm-hmm. So that was the one thing I knew I was good at. I was never good at school because I wasn't curious and I didn't care. Mm. And I was kind of a loner. So I was with this protective, jealous boyfriend for most of my high school. Mm. And with that comes no friends. And then I also had my dancing life that I was kind of ashamed of in a weird way.
Protective, jealous boyfriend was okay with dance world?
Didn't know.
Didn't know?
He would know, but then I would just go back and forth because there was a certain time where my mom wouldn't let me be away from home.
I see.
So I had rules to follow. Mm-hmm. And those were the times that I'd go to the dance studio because I knew he was going to be jealous and controlling and protective. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So there were moments of like that. And then the makeup, breakup. And then there was another one. Mm-hmm. And then there was a dance partner that I danced with who was also abusive. Mm-hmm. That was, And then I moved to LA.
Were these physically abusive relationships,
both.
Emotionally abusive, both?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's a huge burden to carry.
And no one knew. At that time, I was not in therapy.
Right, that's what
I'm
asking.
But I had a lot of older friends in the ballroom world who helped me through, this.
Right.
Because I didn't feel comfortable enough to go to my parents.
Right. So all of this is unprocessed. There's now multiple unprocessed traumas at this point.
Oh, yeah.
Was your dad completely out of your life then?
My real dad?
Point? Yeah, your biological dad.
I mean, he was in Thailand. Uh-huh. Like, I think there was a moment there where we stopped talking for a few years, but it was a constant letdown from, and as I got older, I saw it. But then I remember like that Hong Kong trip, I stopped talking to him for like a few years. That was a choice that I made. And so, I mean, I wouldn't even consider him to be somebody I could call and talk to. But I did tell him everything afterwards, after the fact.
Did the two of you ever get on a more normalized relationship together or not really?
Normal. I would visit him.
You would?
I would. And I brought my dance partner at the time and my dance coach. We went and then I saw the strip clubs really like active, happening face to face there when I was like 18, 19. And then I remember taking my ex-husband there when he was basically on his deathbed.
You mean your dad was on his deathbed?
Yeah, basically.
There. Okay. Mm-hmm. He stayed in Thailand for the rest of his life. Okay.
Yeah.
So now this all sets you up. You're going into adulthood. You're continuing to dance, but you're also continuing to be in relationships.
Yeah. Oh, I was never single.
Okay. You were never single.
No.
So talk about that.
Now, this is the longest I've ever been single.
Oh,
for a year and a half almost.
All right.
Yeah. And I choose to date myself right now. I really do not want to date anybody still.
Okay. So what then, if you were never single, what was that like?
So much energy, emotionally, like an emotional roller coaster. Mm-hmm. But I was addicted to it. Like without it, I felt like my life was boring and stagnant. Though that's my goal now, to be boring, but not boring. You know what I mean? Like that feeling of just being okay and at peace and at ease was something that I was not necessarily craving, because I labeled it as boring and you're not in love then. For me, being in love was the drama that you see on TV.
That's drama bonding.
Yeah.
That's right there. Mm-hmm. That's drama bonding. The chaos becomes conflated with love. And so getting into a relationship that doesn't have the highs and lows and the good days and the bad days and all of that, when it's sort of steady, people will say, well, that's a friendship, or that's not love, or I'm not feeling it, or there's no chemistry.
I see my mom and stepdad. I was like, oh, they're definitely bored with each other. But really, no, that's just a healthy, I wish I would have seen that as a little girl.
I'm just curious about this, because you were in so many relationships, one after the other after the other. Was there a commonality between all of these people?
They were all abusive.
That was the one. Okay, there you go. I was hoping you'd say they all had brown eyes, but okay. So the commonality is they were all abusive.
Yeah, most of them were narcissists, and the ones that weren't, I wasn't that into.
Okay, so let me ask you this then, because it's interesting. When you've had a life where you've had multiple relationships with invalidating, toxic, narcissistic people, what attracted you to these people? I kind of think I know the answer, but I never want to presume.
Every single one of them reminded me of my father.
Okay. Well, there you go.
It is 100% true from either the way they look and the personality traits. I've been cheated on multiple times and knew about it. And it was just a little tiny version of Steve Burke.
When did you have the insight that all of these men that you've dated over the years somehow reminded you of your father?
So this was just maybe 5-6 years ago.
Oh, recently. Oh,
so I have two therapists. I have a somatic and then I have a traditional one, Dr. Wexler, now for a decade every week. And 10 years ago, so I was still drinking. So when she would try and talk to me about it, she told me I wasn't having it. So none of it.
So in those early years, you were just going from man after man who had some
blindly
quality of them resembled your
dad. Absolutely. Yes.
The same chaos, betrayals, all of that over
it's
and
like
over.
It's like clockwork. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, every single
and
one.
It must have been hard, though, to start, stop so many relationships. That takes a toll on you, too. And it kind of makes it sort of concrete that this is just how it is.
Well, I don't know. So this is what it was. I could tell in my body that when it was a nice guy, I was disgusted by them.
Real disgusted, literally that much.
So disgusted, which is just shows you how much I really loved myself, which was not a lot, right? So because I didn't know that. I didn't know that. It was very foreign to me. The only thing that felt like home was these abusive, whether it be emotionally, being gaslit, and that's what I was attracting, and that's what got me going.
Okay, so let's go back a little to what was happening then.
Yeah.
When the abuse was happening in the relationship,
I didn't like the physical abuse. I just want to be clear with anyone listening. Obviously, that's not something that I wanted.
No. But when let's use the emotional abuse, because that's what's so common in narcissistic relationships.
Yeah.
When the emotionally abusive moments were happening, which I'm guessing were things like dismissiveness and criticism and mockery,
jealousy,
and validation,
control.
Jealousy, control, manipulation, gaslighting.
Yes.
What was the story you were telling yourself at those times?
Oh, my God. I don't think I was even aware back then. I don't think I was having that dialogue.
So it was almost like this is just a relationship.
I mean, I watched Pretty Woman when I was too young, obviously. But my nanny, who didn't speak English, she watched three movies. Well, Dynasty wasn't a movie. But Dynasty, and I was watching this with her, Pretty Woman and Sound of Music. Sound of Music's more like it. But at like between ages 3 and 6, like I shouldn't be trying to look like Julia Roberts and dress like a hooker and say, Cheryl, you know, it was interesting. I started this YouTube channel during the pandemic, and I went through all my mom's VHS tapes. For those of you that don't know what a VHS tape is, look it up. and I saw myself. This was insane. Okay. I saw my molester there having like Thanksgiving dinner with all of us, and how nobody was paying any attention to like how creepy this man was hovering over me and, you know, the kids there. And then on top of it all, I saw myself cut to another scene. Do I look pretty? Do I look? And I was like, oh my, this poor child. And that was me. Mm-hmm. And I can tell that I was being influenced. And I do have to tell you that Pretty Woman, I can recite it. Like, I wrote the script, and it's just not okay.
Pretty Woman is not okay. And that maybe one day we'll do an episode all the reasons Pretty Woman is not okay.
No, I seriously.
So, yeah.
Though I still love it, but it's not okay at that age.
Right. I don't know that it's okay at any age.
Really?
Actually, you know, I mean, when you really think about it, right?
No, you're right.
I think they tried to make it, what was the feminist line? Like, one day the prince rescued her, but she rescued him first. I'm like, oh no, honey, it's too late for that line. I think we have done too many problematic things. You are not cleaning this film up with one little rescue line.
No, exactly.
So, but I do think, though, that what you do bring it to is this, the sexualization.
Yes.
That you were sexualized as a child. And this wasn't being seen. I mean, I think that is something we see in any of these sort of what we could call traumatogenic environments, especially where sexual abuse is happening, where it is this unawareness and this disconnection from the experience of the children, from the dynamics within the room. Everyone's sort of so caught up in their own thing, in their own shtick, and all of that. It's a real problem.
It was so hard for me to watch this. Yeah. There was so many emotions going through my body, from anger, resentment. I wanted to reach through the VHS tape, the TV screen, or my laptop, and just be like, shake everybody. Like, what, don't you see it? This was an interesting thing. I don't know if I recommend it, because if you do this, have somebody with you that you trust, because it was like reliving it, but then it was healing all at the same time.
Well, I think it can be, because I think that these things can be, you can see it, you can understand what the influences were, you could understand you were too young to see it, you couldn't make sense of that kind of a storyline, how it gets confused in a child's mind. So now you're going through this sort of series of bad relationships. They're beginning and they're ending. When these relationships would end, who was ending them?
Well, there's lots of ending and coming back together, because I loved the reuniting.
So sometimes it would be the same guy for a back and forth for a while.
Yeah. Okay. Especially this high school one. It and I mean, to the point where he was like stalking me, and I was like, but I always had somebody ready for me to pick up the pieces, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Go from relationship. I'm not kidding. I went from relationship to relationship. Mm-hmm. So I went from like this high school boyfriend straight to my last partner. There was never really a huge gap of transition for me.
Right.
Like
right.
I, in a way, spaced it out, or I didn't have the strength to leave somebody until I had somebody else lined up. And that's... Mm-hmm. That was the pattern.
So the relationships became a place of soothing. They became more of that dissociation, right?
Yeah.
That you know, more of the numbing that you could have.
No matter what.
Because you didn't have to simply be with yourself.
Right.
That's
How
what it stopped
I?
You from from doing that. So I have a very full picture here.
Okay, good.
Okay? The relationships continue in this cycle. Stop, start, they come, they go, chaos, abuse, gaslighting. You're not seeing it. There's no part of you saying, what am I doing? Okay? And that's very common.
Very
common. There's nothing unusual about that.
Well, the worst was like those silent treatments. Oh my God, that would kill me, to the point where actually it was interesting. Those, like, depending on how long the silent treatment went on, like if it was for my dance partner who like I was there in New York with and moved from the Bay Area to New York. And I remember, I'll never forget, like over Thanksgiving, it was like he was gaslighting me and he wouldn't talk to me and didn't talk to me for like a week. And I would call my mom and cry and tell her. But when it comes to any other type of abuse, like physical or mental, I never called my mom. It was just realizing this as I'm talking to you.
Interesting. Yeah. Why do you think that was? Why do you think that because a silent treatment.
That was like more painful than anything.
Because that was an abandonment.
Oh, of course. That was what my dad did.
It was the loss of engagement.
Yeah. I felt
was what the
so
fear was
alone. Yeah. I felt very, I felt abandoned. Period, point blank,
You know, the silent treatment is, it's a common gambit in narcissistic relationships, especially once they realize it works, right? It's very passive aggressive. And what I'm about to say is going to sound very cynical, even I mean, it's just, even I'm surprised by this is cynical, but they get a lot of bang for their buck on that one, right? For no effort. And once they learn it works, they're going to keep doing it, right? Because they're like, oh.
Like works this, meaning like I'm affected.
You're
the
getting
person.
A rise out of the other person.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes. And then you start to control them. Yeah.
And now the silent treatment isn't punitive for everyone, but for most, anyone who has even a secure attachment, it's uncomfortable.
Of course.
But if you have an anxious attachment, it is
really
like flaying
triggering.
A person alive.
Yeah.
Because it's the ultimate, it's worse than abandonment, right? Because it is true abandonment. They're not communicating with you. They've ceased to exist, right? That's the ultimate fear.
Worse is when you're working with a person, too. And then you're living in like a little box in Harlem and the only door separating the two of you is a bathroom door. And then, it was powerful. And it got me every time. Like I felt paralyzed. I don't think I've ever felt that much I think, pain or paralyzation since that time.
Being stuck, being frozen, like you can't. That actually is a sympathetic nervous system response, right? When we think of how, you know, the sympathetic nervous system is an animal, any mammal, it's in a human being, and it's fight, flight, freeze, and fawn. Those are the four.
My therapist says that I'm addicted, that I only know those feelings. So still to this day.
Well, it's a response when you think something catastrophic is happening.
Or not.
Right, or not. But see, the thing is, the silent treatment, when we think about the sympathetic nervous system, it's the same reason why a zebra is able to run away from a lion, right? Everything gets mobilized. All systems shut down except the system that are going to make that zebra's legs move as fast as can be away from the lion. Once they're out of harm's way, they go right back to parasympathetic functioning
They graze. Themselves.
They're just chill, right?
Yeah.
So a lion chasing the zebra is a true mortal threat.
Yes, yes, yes.
A person giving you the silent treatment is actually not a mortal threat. But your brain interprets it that way. But when you keep turning the sympathetic nervous system on and off, freeze, 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 freeze.
It's just not good
for
you.
There's all this wear and tear on the body.
Of course. Amen, sister. Amen.
That's what it is. It's the wear and tear. It's not as simple as like, oh, I'll just keep fighting and freezing. No.
You don't want.
There's an opportunity cost there.
But so is there a way now to get a little deeper on this? Is there a way to be addicted to it?
To those responses? Yeah. I don't know that you were as addicted to the sympathetic response.
Or is it just feeling like home? Like, I only know that.
I always use the word addiction very carefully when it comes to sort of these relational cycles.
Okay.
Because it turns the person being harmed into a active actor, participant in
it. Okay, okay, I hear you.
Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
And so I always steer away from that because I think that languaging has been used to use a disease model to capture a person who's going through psychological manipulation.
I hear you. Two
so
separate
that's
things.
Separate. You know, yes, but it's also not putting survivors in a passive role.
But you only knew
what you knew.
Yes.
And for you, the relief of tension that would come when the person would come back around was still the fantasy you held around the father who was not going to leave, who was going to show up, who was going to come to Hong Kong, who was going to be there, who was going to be a decent human being at some level when you needed him to be a father, that men could be safe.
Yeah.
But your templates for men across the board were unsafe. And even though you loved and cared about your stepfather, he brought danger into your life unwittingly.
Oh, yeah.
So you see what I'm saying? So it's like all of that became danger.
Yeah.
And so
every man,
every man behaved in a way that was dangerous,
that
represented that.
Because that's all I knew.
Right. And so the hypothesis kept coming and then the safe men were disgusting. So you weren't interacting with them.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
Right. It's not crazy. It actually kind of makes sense.
I know it's not crazy. Yeah, no, totally. It does.
And it does
helps with feeling more compassionate towards myself.
So you said you haven't been in a relationship for a year and a half.
Well, yes, after my divorce.
Okay.
I've been single.
So you got married.
Mm-hmm.
May I ask how long you were married for?
2 years.
2 years. Okay. Mm-hmm. And how long were you together before the marriage?
So we were together in the beginning. When I first moved to LA, I would say 2007 for a couple of years, broke up for 10 years, reunited for a year and a half, got married.
Okay. All right. So it was an on and off relationship.
Yeah.
And then you got married.
Yeah.
Did you also find yourself repeating some of your same patterns in this relationship? Okay.
So, I'm not saying anything about that person,
right.
But yes, you're asking the
question. The similar patterns.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. For sure. They looked very much alike.
Your father and this person.
I mean, he would agree too if you heard this. So
you have not had a relationship with an adult man, an intimate romantic relationship with an adult man that was ever healthy at this point?
No.
No. Okay. All right. So do you have hope that you can?
Yes, but I have to get myself healthy first. Yeah.
Got it. All right. So it's not as though you've ruled that out. Because, Cheryl, there's people in your position will sometimes say, I'm out. I fold. This is not my game.
And then what
I'm not doing it. I'm going to be alone forever.
Oh, well, I can only live right now, right? Like, I can't tell the future. However, I'd love to get married again. This is another thing I have to work on at therapy. I go from like zero to a 1,000. So, of course, I still believe in it. I mean, I don't know if I know the definition of a perfect relationship is, but I know that I will continue the pattern if I don't change myself.
So let me ask you this. What do you think a healthy relationship looks like?
Two individuals. That's very important.
I'm writing these
down. Because I thought that we were one here.
Okay.
The notebook doesn't help, so they should take that off the fucking... Sorry, excuse my language.
Oh, no, you can say, talk away. The Notebook, you mean the
movie. The movie needs to go away. All these movies about love.
We could make a dysfunctional movie.
Or is it dysfunctional?
Playlist.
I think dysfunction is normal. So
I don't know. He was really stalky in the beginning of the relationship.
The Notebook?
Yeah. I heard that.
You too.
No, but don't you think like he jumped? He climbed up the Ferris wheel.
My brain
versus your
brain.
That felt like, you see, like I was like,
loved it.
Boundary violation. She's saying
no.
No does not mean yes.
I was like, why doesn't that happen to me?
No. Stalky. And they've romanticized. I'm like, I'm going to keep coming by. And I'm going to keep coming by and insisting. And you're about to marry someone else. So I'm going
to
keep coming by.
I have to watch it again now.
Keep coming by. I really should have healthy movie night.
No, really. You should do like a rewatch.
A screening, yeah. And we'll come together and say, can we talk about why that was not healthy? No, that was so
anxious
romantic.
Anxious attachment, avoidant attachment, and psychopathic personality traits. Like, that's definitely what you should do.
Well, I think what happens is it's an ends justify the means kind of thing. Like, oh, they were old together, and they had the kids, and they had the this, and then, you know,
and
whatever.
They had the sex,
Shower sex and the swans and the water. But ahead of all of that was the stalky fair behavior, right? She had a terrible mother.
See,
I
mean, it would get me every time, that stalkery behavior. Like,
wow.
In a good,
okay, so,
th- so that was a
note
good,
to self, yeah, no, Cheryl. If someone's behaving like no stalking, if somebody climbs a Ferris wheel, don't date them.
It actually reminds me of how I basically, in a weird way, the stalking from my ex was actually enticing.
Okay, so it's good. And here's the thing. I think it's so important you say that out loud, right?
Yeah.
Because there's absolutely no shame in saying that, because you're saying like there was something.
That was my definition of love.
That was your definition of love. Because you know what it was? It was unmistakable, right? So it's like a volume button. If something's at volume 90, you're going to hear it, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas anything more subtle, don't know about that. But like, because of that, not being able to get that consistently, especially from your father, there was no ambiguity. Mm-hmm. Stalking is like, oh, you're into me, right?
Yes.
So it becomes this massive overcorrection.
Yes.
And so it's really important that you say, like you, and I think for people to say, well, I don't want to say that, entice me, because then that makes me look bad. No, it doesn't.
No.
It helps you understand what was happening.
Yes,
the work becomes, you know, unraveling.
Unfolding it.
Yeah, unpacking why that would have been enticing, because many
people
say,
a lot of people feel like they must feel like they're crazy, honestly.
Well, no, what a lot of people feel is that, and I get this, it's Dr. Romney, are you kidding me? Like, I feel guilty. I feel dirty. I like love bombing.
Yeah,
I'm like,
no,
love bombing's great. If you could find a respectful, that's the whole full court press. Baby, you're my everything. Presents, dinners out, showing up a lot, texting you 25 times a day. I can't stop thinking about you. Right. Right. And so,
see, I'm not, my love language is not gifts, but it's definitely.
But you know what I mean? The intensity, the flowers, the night out.
Got me every time.
Yep. And so, somebody said, well, is there ever healthy love bombing? And I mean, if you could find a person who is nice, kind, respectful,
gifts,
all that disgusting stuff, as you call it.
Yeah, right.
And
those
does all
love,
of that.
That's not love bombing.
They tend not to go together. Like a healthier person's going to have a little bit more of a
like
normal
trust.
Pace.
Right. Let's talk about the healthy relationship.
Okay, so you've only given me two individuals,
Cheryl. Two individuals. Okay, trust.
Mm-hmm.
For me, is accountability. I've realized this recently, that I can't even have friends who don't hold themselves accountable.
That's great. Okay.
Supporting each other, obviously, as someone who is not jealous in that sense of your career or success. Very secure attachment would be great. Wanting to evolve constantly, learn, grow, and patience and kind, cute would help. I'm kidding.
Mm-hmm. That's fine.
And successful, their own life. Successful meaning not just like the amount of money they have in their bank account, but successful like the confidence that they have from within. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So
a good listener.
Okay,
would be great.
Great.
I mean, I can go on all day.
These are the things that make a healthy relationship. Two individuals, and by that I understand what you mean.
Okay.
Not two people are so enmeshed.
We're not like that, one. Yeah. Not.
So two people where there's a sense of separateness, but you know.
And all in, like 100%. There's no 50-50 in my eyes.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Trust, there's trust, there's accountability, the two people support each other, there's a sense of safety, growth orientation, patient, kind, that you find them cute. These are things that describe a healthy person. Some of this could describe...
Oh, you're asking about relationship.
Relationship. What makes a healthy relationship?
I think, really, though, for me, I think just because I only can talk based off my experience, but it is allowing for the other person to be their own person.
Okay.
I think that is a big thing for me. I tend to get very consumed.
Got it. Okay, so I got
whether
that.
Whether it's a person or a job, right?
What else?
So communication is key.
Mm-hmm. What does communication mean to you?
Well, responsive communication would help, meaning like I'm also this weird, not weird. I'm very like to the second, with time. Mm-hmm. And so when someone says they're going to be there and they're not there at that time with no phone call saying that they're going to be late, it really irks me. Mm-hmm. So then my brain starts to think, oh, my God, they're cheating. Oh, my God. Like, I fall down this rabbit hole.
Oh, so
it's shit.
And it's interesting you go there because you could take it as they don't call you. It's like they're actually not respectful of a standard that I put out there.
Oh, no.
Which is what they're doing. And that is enough for it to be a problem.
That's a healthy brain. Yes.
Right?
Yes.
That's enough for it to be a problem.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm hearing so far that you've got here, we're going
to
talk about a fancy word, but it's a good fancy word.
Okay.
There's a term out there called intersubjectivity. It's used by a guy named Dan Shaw, who's a therapist who does fantastic work in narcissistic relationships. Okay. But the concept of intersubjectivity is the idea that two people can be in a relationship and have their own experience and perceptions and simultaneously also recognize that the other person is having their own experience and perceptions, right? So that's kind of the opposite of gaslighting, right? So simplest example, you go out to dinner with somebody and he says, this was absolutely terrible. And you're like, oh my gosh, like this was the best lasagna I've ever had.
Yeah, two different,
right?
Yes, yes.
And you don't say to him, so you're wrong. There's no way your pasta could be, or he couldn't turn to say, there's no way your lasagna was good because my meal was bad. That would be a great example of there not being intersubjectivity.
No, I hear
it's an
you.
Overly simple example.
Got it.
But it's that capacity to do that. Mm-hmm. That's a core pillar here. What you're talking about also, though, is respecting boundaries
respecting boundaries, and also I think transparency is very important.
Okay,
right,
and that goes back to the trusting and the accountability.
Yes,
and so, but a lot of the stuff you're laying out here, interestingly, Cheryl, is very much related to stuff like trust, boundaries.
Oh, I think
safety,
that's my number one. Trigger.
Right,
yeah.
It's understandable because that's all going back to that secure base kind of stuff.
Okay,
safety is everything to people who've been through trauma.
Not to everybody in general.
I think that for everybody in general, they already have that internalized sense of it,
so
sort of feel that
they expect that is.
There's a risk in that too, though, because if something terrible happens to them, they may go through the world as though it's a little bit safer. I'll put it this way to you. I'm a trauma survivor too, not nearly at the level you have, but definitely a trauma survivor. And I definitely go through work a little bit like
a
military,
hypervigilant.
Hypervigilant.
No, if you were to label
it's not. It's not
but
good.
I am so, and I don't, I think the ballroom community, the competitive, because we dance all on the dance floor together. So my hypervigilance is quite scary.
What do you mean by scared? Because to me, it's a normal trauma response.
But I'm too vigilant to where, like, it's hard for me. I don't know if there's such a thing, but, like, I am too aware of my...
Well, it's exhausting.
Paranoia, almost.
Well, I think that it's exhausting. If it's paranoia, if you think it's resulting in people coming at you or harming you.
I used to.
Okay, so that's come down a little bit.
Oh, but a lot of it.
Then it's the idea is that, but hypervigilance is exhausting.
It is.
So, right, you almost want to view it as when you have too many apps and stuff open on your phone, your phone's running slow.
Yeah.
That's what hypervigilance does. Right. It just slows you down and it completely depletes your bandwidth because you're like, and there's a thing over there and there's a sound over there and there's a this and there's a that. And it saps our capacity to be mindful.
Right. And since my sobriety, it's been even stronger.
My conversation will continue after this break.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
So talk about that. Talk about your journey of sobriety, because you had talked about how you are sober. Mm-hmm. So around 21, you had your first drink. Almost, and then what happened?
And then I used it when I first started drinking. It was mainly to calm my anxiety down from paparazzi.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was pretty bad when I first came here in 2006. My dance partner, just to give you some perspective here, was Nick Lachey's little brother, Drew Lachey. This was during the height of him and Jessica Simpson's divorce.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I come here from New York at the time, and I had no voice. Like, I had no opinion, didn't know what my favorite color was. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, people wanting to ask me a question when I was so used to taking the back seat and being a follower, not a leader, was an adjustment. So my anxiety was through the roof, though I couldn't even put words to it at that moment.
Yeah.
So alcohol helped.
Yeah,
but I was
a
functioning alcoholic, so no one knew that I was even, I mean, I was normal in their eyes.
So you didn't have impairments at work? It's not like you missed rehearsals or
never.
Shows or anything like that? Okay, so but it was, the drinking got out of control.
It got out of control to the point where I was drinking 7 days a week. Mm-hmm. Now, I never, when people ask me what my rock bottom is, it's almost like my rock bottom was the fact that I was at my height of success when I was drinking. And that I never really, my rock bottom, if you were to think about it now, for me at least, as a sober person trying to stay sober one day at a time, if I think back, like when big things happen, like my divorce or, you know, leaving Dancing with the Stars, when something mildly traumatic, I guess, because I don't know if you want to, I don't know if you don't measure it, but if anything traumatic like that or anything that changes in my life that's drastic, I do at times think about drinking. And then I think about, you know what? Fuck it. I was the most successful when I was drinking anyway. So that to me is a rock bottom. It's not necessarily checking into rehab.
Right. So you got sober on your own. You did 12 step?
Yes, I'm still very much involved. I do have a sponsor, and to say it's not a battle, it would be a lie. But I quit basically for vanity reasons, because I started as soon as my dad died. I came home, had a drink, and I busted out into hives. And this was right before my engagement party, and so I decided to stop because of vanity reasons.
Okay, well, any port in a storm. I would guess, though, those hives were probably from stress.
Yes.
Right. You co-located them with the alcohol. So
my body was,
whatever it takes. Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I think that
reacting.
A lot of things were happening at the same time.
Yeah. And I didn't know how to feel it. So.
So now you have to cope without the alcohol. So you've taken one form of numbing away, but you've acknowledged, though, that another form of numbing is you've also taken two forms of numbing away. The chaotic relationships and the men. And the alcohol. You've now turned to work. And, you know, and
or
that, you
busy.
Know, or staying busy. That can be a tricky pattern. But now you've been single for a year and a half. You know, I tell people that people who are coming out of narcissistic relationship, and in you, your case, it's been a series of many narcissistic relationships, right? Is that I tell them you got to do Dr. Romney's 12-month detox. And by that, I mean you got to spend a year
alone. Can it be more than 12 months?
It can be absolutely more than 12 months. And people say, what are you about? What's the 12 months of it all? And I said, in that year, you have to encounter every single anniversary date, thing, issue, street corner, restaurant you fought alone, right? And so, and holidays are tough for people, right? Holidays, birthdays, dates that something happened in your relationship that had some meaning.
Media, and press.
Take them all back, and you need a year. A lot can happen
in
a year.
Yes. So it is, I need more than a year.
And I think more than a year isn't a bad thing, but a minimum of a year. And people are saying, are you kidding me? A year? And I said,
I know that too. I was like, if you told me this years ago, I'd be like, I'm not talking to you ever again.
No. And a lot of people have said that, like, they're saying no sex, no touch.
Yeah.
I'm like, yep. And you will, I mean, even if it's a way of finding self-embrace, whatever that looks like to you, but that coming back to yourself, because healing from narcissistic abuse or narcissistic relationships, the key pillar of that is coming into yourself, allowing yourself to be an individual outside of the shadow of anybody
else. So it's normal
what
I'm doing.
Not only absolutely normal, I'm signing off on it, and I don't sign off on much.
Thanks.
So
yes.
It's, I mean, it is that 12 months.
I'm not even interested.
Good.
Like,
good.
Don't be,
that's great.
Is it 6 years then since I've dated maybe a total of 6 to 7 narcissists? I'm kidding.
Yeah, no. You might need longer than a year, my dear, after all you've been through.
Definitely.
You know?
I'm going to tell my therapist this.
But
it's all good.
It's a coming back into oneself, and I don't believe a person can go on that journey with somebody else, right? So I say to people, you don't even know what thermostat setting you like because it was always what they wanted, right? You don't know what you want.
I didn't even know my favorite
pizza.
Color was.
You don't
I was
know
21.
Your favorite color.
I had no idea.
You don't know anything.
Yeah.
So you need to go out there and have all that. What pizza toppings do you like? Do you even like pizza? Mm-hmm. Do you want the thermostat at 68 or 62 or 75? What kinds of movies do you like?
Yeah.
You know, what's
I
a
could
perfect
actually,
Sunday?
I'm so proud of myself. I can answer all your questions.
That's great. And a lot of folks will say, they'll struggle. They'll say, I know what that is, but, and they'll recognize they're still using the narcissistic person as a frame of reference.
Wow.
So that's really what coming out of it is.
Like I said, we could just do a 10-parter to this. This could be a whole season.
Just Cheryl and Dr. Romney.
Yeah.
Great.
Hey.
We'll do that.
Yeah.
That's great.
Exactly.
Super.
No, but this is all very helpful. I just love this all. I love
great.
It, though it's hard to hear sometimes, but it just helps.
What was the hardest thing you learned about narcissistic relationships that you had to take in that was necessary for you to push through your healing?
I think what was hard for me, first of all, was to wrap my head around the fact that I was only attracted to them.
Mm.
However, it helps to continue to educate myself by, for example, listening to your podcast and doing more research. And it helps to then find the compassion, because when you really hear repeatedly over and over again that it has nothing to do with the survivor, you can breathe. It takes a load off.
Yeah, I'm actually going to push back on this idea that you say, well, I've always been attracted to narcissists. I don't actually think
or
that's
I only
true.
Knew narcissists.
I think that
that
for
was my
you,
normal.
You were attempting to work through a pattern, right? If you're to bring people down to some brass tacks, especially trauma survivors, it's the seeking not only of safety, but of attachment and of love and of connection, right?
Yeah.
What you were trying to do was healthy.
Mm-hmm.
You were trying to bring connection into your life, love, attachment, all of that. Your template was skewed and damaged and harmed by trauma.
Right, at a young age.
At a young age.
Mm-hmm.
And so then what ends up happening is that there is the up and down and the chaos of those relationships is you're not registering them as a problem.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And keep in mind too, Cheryl, I think one of the challenges of narcissistic relationships is it's not terrible every day.
Mm.
The good days were really good.
They were great.
Really good.
Yeah. And that's what I would hold on to.
Right,
obviously.
And you'd hold on to that. And then into huge narratives can
be
crafted.
Well, that's why the makeup and breakup was so great, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Then you got to have it all again and have it all again. And so I think that this idea of the narcissistic person as having horns and a forked tail and all of that is nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
These are incredibly charming, charismatic, fun, interesting people.
Charismatic is definitely the word.
Yeah, I mean,
that's
they're very compelling.
Mm-hmm.
And so be hard on anyone to be hard on themselves for saying, I was drawn to someone who's really interesting, smart, and compelling.
Right.
That's a normal want. It's the also giving yourself permission to say, that might have all been good, but this is not healthy.
No.
So I got to disengage from that.
You.
For you, that disengagement was never going to happen because that was still working through this other kind of a cycle. Dr. Jennifer Fried, she talks about this thing called betrayal blindness and how when we're being betrayed, you don't see it. You don't acknowledge it. You almost don't register it. And when you don't do that, the relationship can continue, right? And
Is it because you're avoiding to see it or you just don't see it?
It's not safe to see it.
Uh-huh.
It means you're not going to be able to maintain attachment, connection, and love. Like you'll lose something too important, right?
Yeah.
You've had to learn to do that since you were so small, right?
Mm-hmm.
Seeing dad having sex through a door, having been abused. And in fact, interestingly, in that case, you were willing to acknowledge what it was, which was actually quite remarkable. But, you know, in the sense of you testified in that case.
Right, because not everyone testified,
You know, but yes, not everyone testified.
Yeah.
But then in these other relationships in adulthood, you know, treating me badly, cheating on me, whatever they're doing, it's like whoosh, whoosh. And in fact, you use this beautiful analogy of it just whooshes away.
Mm-hmm.
And when it whooshes away, you can stay in the relationship. But the problem is that comes with an opportunity cost as you kind of just whooshing all this and rubbing all
meaning
this stuff
like
away.
That's
not a thing. Or
like, no, okay.
That's a, they,
oh, you mean
cool.
Just like being blind.
Just being literally, what she calls betrayal blind.
Okay,
you know, that's how she calls it.
Okay.
What she refers
not like
to it
pushing
as.
Pushing it away.
No.
But
like
pretending
to those
not
betrayals,
to see it.
Like,
it.
Okay, yeah, we're good. We're
yes,
good.
Yes.
Right?
Mm.
The problem is that we're good. It's not really, because it's all piling up. And
as
it piles up, you're feeling anxious. You're feeling sad. You're feeling a sense of despair. You're drinking. You're feeling worthless. So all this unhealthy stuff is coming up behind it. But you keep having that not acknowledging. And then one day you acknowledge. In each of those relationships, those 6-7 relationships, something happened. And like you said, you'd quickly pivot into a new relationship, but something ended it. Maybe you kind of saw it, but it seems like now, after all you've been through, being in therapy, you are now able to see, oh, that person cheated on me.
Oh,
that person mistreated me. And you can't unsee
it. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you can't unsee it.
No. But it was interesting. The very first physical abusive relationship was pretty bad. And then it was interesting how I was blind to seeing like the welts on my legs.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's it.
You know,
I'm not acknowledging. Right. I'm not processing it.
But now I'm so sensitive to any type of emotional abuse, let alone person wouldn't even dare to touch me. But maybe it's an overreaction, but I don't think it is. It's just for me, it's a boundary that you just don't cross.
Great.
And whatever. And right away, it's a red flag. So then I leave. Like, it's just like, you're done in 2 seconds.
So last few questions.
Sure.
Okay. You've worked on your mental health. You've worked through a lot of your trauma. You're maintaining sobriety. How is all of that going for you, especially in light of you've gone through some major relationship changes and leaving Dancing with the Stars? These are two big changes for you.
Yes.
Okay?
Yeah.
So how do you balance, all of the healing against these two major transitions?
I don't think it's separate.
Okay.
I think that the reason why I did leave both situations you just mentioned is because of the fact that I'm healing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think that it works hand in hand.
Yes, it does.
But
it's
scary as shit.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to say that my sobriety has been easy and that I'm healed, because it's going to be a lifelong battle and amazingness sometimes and not so amazing sometimes. And my job is just to take this life one day at a time.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is a lifelong battle. And I think that's the reality of it. That there will be those dark nights of the soul.
But it's not a battle, I guess.
I think it's a journey. It's a process.
It is. And it's heavy as shit and it's exhausting. But there's more days of not feeling like that than if I were just to wing it.
Yeah.
Life.
Yeah. That's great. I mean, and that's progress. And now what I hear that's so promising is that you acknowledge what happened, right? If we talked to you, like you said, 9 years ago, you wouldn't
what?
And I would have been offended and defensive about everything
you would have
said.
And
then, and that just simply means you weren't in that moment of readiness, just like you had with your therapist. She'd bring it up. You're like, no, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And for any of us who are therapists, like, okay,
I mean, I think there's certain things I'm still not ready to talk about.
And you'll get
most
there.
Most likely.
Right.
You know?
You'll get there. So how do you feel about getting into a new relationship?
Not.
Okay. So that's
me, myself, and my friend.
And your dog. I love that. Okay.
And I am just currently... Look, there's moments of feeling lonely, but I'm more alone than lonely. Like, I'm not lonely.
I agree. There's a big difference.
Like, I actually crave being alone now.
That's great.
And I guess I'm not for small talk anymore. Like, there's a lot of things that I'm learning about myself. Becomes a very small, tiny little group of people.
That's great.
Since I got sober, everything's changed. But also, as hard as I have been curious to work, a lot's changed. I'm proud of myself. And I don't think I could have ever said that.
Which is great, because I think that what you're saying is always that you're able to, in being alone, you feel safe. And that's
more
a big
safe
deal.
Than being with people.
Yes, right. And there was a time when you didn't feel safe when you were alone. That's a huge sort of a transitional,
leap,
which is really, really great. You're also talking about discernment. You have a small group of friends. That is about discernment, that not anyone can get through the gate.
Yeah.
And that's a big deal for survivors, right?
Boundaries in general.
Yes, boundaries in general.
Big deal for me.
But say that again. You said you're proud of yourself.
Yeah, no, I am really proud of myself. I love myself. Like, I actually do. Mm-hmm. And the more I continue to make these decisions, whether they be big, small, or however you want to measure it, it had to be done in order for me to continue on this path of healing. Because if I continued in any type of relationship or workplace with feeling like I'm not being respected or treated the way I should be, I'm leaving.
Which is, again, we're back to discernment, which is a huge part of healing from these relationships. And I have to say, listen, nobody else can do sixth grade for you, right? You got to go through the pain of all of algebra and whatever you got to do in sixth grade.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with this. I think that when a person can get through this, They can see it. Mm-hmm. They have the supports. They have therapy. Mm-hmm. They have friends. They have
just resources,
activities
yeah.
that they love yes. to do.
I love to diamond paint.
You know, perfect.
Big
you know,
diamond painter over diamond here. Diamond painting. Arts and crafts. Who knew?
Arts and crafts, which is great. You have your pup. You have
yes.
all those things.
Busy.
All, that, I have to tell you, one thing I don't know that I'm going to ever be able to do is my fantasy has always been I could help people get ahead of it. I could teach people how to identify these patterns and mm-hmm. stop them from ever getting in the first place. I'm not seeing
that
happen.
That's such a great goal.
You know, most yeah. people say, anyone who hasn't been through it, they are no interest
no.
in what I have to say.
No.
And I hate to say it, but I'm like, everybody's going to come by this bus stop yeah. soon enough.
No, you're
so
right.
don't you worry about
you're
that.
Right. And if you don't, yeah. you're just
but
living.
It's yeah. tough. It's almost yeah. like telling a teenager, don't do this, don't do this. You have to just hope
yes.
that, yeah, call it sort of harm reduction. At least how can we make your fall as soft as possible? Because you're going to fall.
It's gonna
and you're going to make the mistake.
Either a so, hardcore, you know, but it's not so, black or white. Yeah, yeah it's mm-hmm. going to be, you're falling. Yeah. We're falling.
Your story is amazing because you've been through it and you are so self-reflective on what happened and how it mm-hmm. happened and even the parts of it that were enticing, and you own it. And, you know, you've come to this place. I don't think you could come to this place without, in some ways, sadly walking through
yeah.
some of these steps. And
yeah,
that's,
you're making
I mean,
me cry.
I think
this is actually a really big deal. I don't cry, but, like, I'm trying just to feel. And so thank you for
It's
everything.
Amazing. You don't
thank
know how many
you.
People need to hear this.
Thank you.
Because it's really, it's remarkable when I hear someone come
thank
all
you.
The way you came.
Thank
so
you.
Thank you.
Thank you for everything you do.
Well, I'm so happy.
You're the new Oprah. Who knew?
I think a touch more cynical than darling Oprah, but I think that, you know what? We need a cynical
yeah.
Oprah in our new,
yes.
that's the
and
new
an
world
Asian
order.
Oprah.
And,
like, no,
and
God.
I mean, two Asian Oprahs,
exactly,
South Asian.
Exactly.
We got it. And you know what? There's more people in Asia than anywhere else. So
you're
we've
right.
got the viewership.
Amen, sister.
So that's what
and
I'm
you
saying.
You are a sister.
And you are too. And I can't dance a step. So maybe one day
Don't worry.
You can teach me.
I will.
That's right.
I
and
will.
Then I can keep teaching you about narcissism.
As long as I have
trade.
These free sessions, we're good.
You
I'll
got
teach
it.
You a cha-cha
great.
Any day.
Great. Here are my takeaways from my conversation with Cheryl. First, people often think that finding love is the ultimate sign of success and healing. However, for many people, it actually may be a period of solitude. Cheryl's story shows us that getting to know who you are outside of a relationship is the true summit of healing. Your process might not look like everyone else's, and that's okay. In our next takeaway, Cheryl talked about stalking being enticing. Now, what she's calling stalking may be that obsessive, intrusive, unrelenting interest, the constant checking in, or the incessant need to pull someone back into a relationship. Cheryl's feelings are common. As a psychologist, I've seen many people shamed for admitting that they found this behavior appealing. For people like Cheryl, who have acknowledged attachment issues, this intense interest can feel like an antidote to the fear of abandonment and create a false sense of security, but unfortunately will lead to a very unhealthy and toxic relationship. In this next takeaway, Cheryl found that understanding attachment styles was very helpful. Understanding attachment behaviors means going back to early childhood. Remember, children need attachment to survive. But if there are early disruptions in these attachments, that will have implications for our adult relationships. There are believed to be four types of adult attachment styles. The first is secure. These are folks who are able to make mutual, safe, and sustained relationships, are not preoccupied with being abandoned or with rejection while they're in relationships, and are comfortable with closeness. The second is the avoidant attachment style, which looks like someone who is not comfortable with being or getting close and may feel that they don't need their partner. People with this attachment style may pull away when people try to get close. With the third style, the anxious attachment style, this is someone who feels insecure about close relationships, even as they want these relationships. There can be a real fear of abandonment or rejection and a belief that they overwhelm partners with their needs for closeness. And finally, there's also the anxious-avoidant mix, where people are not only not comfortable with close relationships, but they are also anxious about the relationship, so trust and a fear of getting close to a partner are issues. It can be useful to know your attachment style as well as your partner's if you're in a relationship, because it can give you insight about how you move through relationships and the cycles you get stuck into. Having a history of narcissistic parents or early trauma can definitely put a person at risk for anxious avoidant or anxious avoidant attachment styles, and having an anxious or an avoidant anxious attachment style can also put you at risk for getting stuck in unhealthy antagonistic and narcissistic relationship cycles. You aren't doomed, and therapy can be an important place to explore these patterns within yourself and establish secure attachment skills you can take into close relationships. In our show notes, you'll find a quiz that can help you determine your attachment style. In this next takeaway, Cheryl shared that for a while, healthy people who could offer her a healthy relationship disgusted her. And that is not unusual, especially if someone is prone to trauma bonding and has a relationship template that love is rejection and chaos and invalidation, and of actually finding comfort in the breakup, makeup, reunion cycles. It makes sense, and it is part of what she observed at a young age, but we are not defined by our histories. It does take work to make the transition to experiencing these less volatile and chaotic relationships as satisfying, and that work often has to be done while we are not in a relationship and through psychotherapy. And for our last takeaway, Cheryl shared that she is single now and has been for over a year after an adult life of only being in relationships. Solitude is an essential part of healing from narcissistic relationships. And I wasn't kidding when I talked about a 12-month detox, a period of time when you are out of a romantic relationship and learning about yourself, and learning how to be with yourself without a relationship, to become familiar with who you are without having to shape yourself to what someone else needs you to be. This development of identity, autonomy, and sense of self can be stolen if you have been in nonstop narcissistic relationships from a young age, and spending time on your own, overwhelming as it may feel, is essential to healing. Relationships can be a place to hide, numb, and not do the work of becoming our authentic selves. It's a chance for your nervous system to take a rest and for you to be able to focus on your emotions and your whole self.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah. And some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.